Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. 2 hours of programming, important topics always. So much going on. Let's get into the first hour. My guest, Jim, I think I could call you an old favorite on the News Hour. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be on your program, particularly because you present an alternative viewpoint, which doesn't get relayed on the mass media. So.
Well, Jim, it's because of people like you, and I must tell listeners your last name, and then for those who don't know you, explain who you are. James Petras is my guest, and Jim is Professor Emeritus at Binghamton University, New York. And my goodness, it would take me half the program, Jim, to list all your credentials. They are so long and impressive, but you've written, oh my goodness, over 60 books. Absolutely incredible. I can't imagine that, but you've done it. You write many hundreds of articles. You're a long-time noted academic figure of great distinction. You've done so much in your very impressive years. You've got a new book out now. I've gotten into a few of your... I've read about a dozen of your books, I think, Jim, and I've written a little bit about a few of them, and your newest book is called Zionism, Militarism, and the Decline of U.S. Power. And we want to talk about that, plus maybe some other things going on in the world. It's a very active world these days, Jim. I think we could say that.
Yes, I think it's really one of the most striking periods as far as the collapse of American capitalism, if not world capitalism. I'm thinking about the perfect storm of a financial debacle in which the only thing holding the American financial system, propping it up, is the role of the state in buying banks and pumping money into the credit markets. That's no longer... Capitalism can't save itself. It has to call in the states to put in the public to make the at least prop it up. And then the economy is going into what the Bernanke central banker says may be a major depression. So it seems as if life itself is showing that capitalism doesn't work anymore.
It doesn't work the way it's gone on. I think you've seen that for many years. And for a guy myself, a product of the Wharton School, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but it's true. A different world back then. Well, it was the same world, just not as extreme as it is now. Back when I got out in 1960, Jim, but it was a little bit calmer. But extremes seem to beget more extremes, and they really created one heck of a mess for themselves this time. I don't generally write about economic matters or financial matters, but I just can't get away from this one, Jim. I put out an article today that I sent you. You may have taken a peek at it, called Hard Times. And I've got another one right behind it that's going to come out in a couple of days. And you just got to follow what's happening and see where this thing leads. But there will be lots of books written about this time. And I'm not good at making predictions, so I try to stay away from them. But the potential for real, real serious trouble that could rival some of the worst we've ever seen in this country very definitely is with us now.
Yes, I agree. I think this is really a systemic crisis. I don't think there's much dissent on that, even from the supporters of capitalism. I think there's a universal agreement that the free market version of capitalism has absolutely failed, and there's no way to bring it back to life.
Jim, let's take a break, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with James Petras. We'll be talking about the Middle East, militarism, Israeli policy, the Zionist lobby, the financial crisis. Jim, when we hear that music strike up in the background, it means momentarily they're going to cut in on us. So if I don't do it, they will. we'll have a few more of those before the hour is over, but we still have plenty of time to talk about things. Should we go a little more on the financial crisis and then jump into your book? I leave it to you.
Well, we can just comment on, first of all, I don't think you need to be a prophet to see that the capitalist system's collapsing in the U.S. Silicon Valley just announced huge job losses. It's spreading into all sectors of the economy. The U.S. consumer is 70% of the U.S. economy. That's dropping precipitously. We have the hedge funds that are losing money, and billions are fleeing those speculative instruments. Automobile industry is almost bankrupt. General Motors in particular, their credit rating is next to junk, or is junk already. Layoffs, massive layoffs are spreading across the country. Consumers are not spending. Credit card bankruptcies and purchases of items less than housing, cars and other items. I think we are absolutely in a major recession right now. We are in a major breakdown of the credit system. I think there's absolutely no question at this time that all of the major economic policymakers are stymied. They have no alternatives. They just know how to spend government money, but without any understanding of the failed institutions that they're giving the money to. I think it's going to take a while for the American public to recognize this, but I think it's very clear that there is here a need to put socialism back on the agenda. Since the government is playing such a big role, it should play that role on behalf of the majority of the population and not as a prop for Wall Street. Most people recognize that it shouldn't serve Wall Street. Most people agree the state should take up a big role in the economy. And I think we need to explain to people that extending public ownership, public intervention, public planning has to take place on behalf of the interests of the great majority of the people, and that the sum total of that is socialism.
Well, you know, Jim, I think they're kidding themselves not to do that, because back in the 1930s, as things really, really began sinking, the powers that be, it wasn't just FDR, a lot of smart people around him, including industrialists, realized that capitalism was on the ropes, and they had to get activists and prop up people, ordinary people. These are the people that go out and buy their products. So people were losing their homes. Home prices dropped 30%, foreclosures all over the place, the way they're happening now. And they set up a federal home loan bank to take the value of, I mean, just one of many things. I mean, this is such a core problem today, people losing their homes. I quoted
losing
one
their homes, losing their house, losing their credit cards, losing their capacity to meet time payments on all sorts of household, basic household items. This is the big enchilada that many people prophesized for decades and were made fun of. And I think now that it's happening, what's surprising is that the trade unions, you don't hear anything from the trade unions. You don't hear any powerful organization saying, this is the end of capitalism. Let's start with an alternative system. This is a big surprise to me. Everybody knows the system's collapsing. Everybody feels it either in their own lives or in people close to them. So I think it's a question now of putting on the table the exact alternative that we want to talk about, and that requires people to reinvestigate what democratic socialism would look like in the United States given extended public ownership. But anyway, I don't think any of this is realistic when the two major candidates for the presidency still talking about continuing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and threats to Iran, supporting Israel's military bellicosity. I think nothing is possible until we get political leaders willing to end the war and begin to use our resources to extend the public domain in the United States and create jobs, infrastructure, public works. This is what's on the agenda, and you can't do that with a $1 trillion deficit and $800 billion military budget. That's not possible to continue militarism and a collapsing domestic economy.
And as you write about in your book, the very powerful Israeli lobby that drives us toward the military side. And right now, I mean, we are in a situation where we have guns and butter writ large. And, I mean, the deficit is exploding. The deficit is much, much bigger than publicly acknowledged. But just one act, on one day, when the government took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they increased the national debt by $5 trillion.
I mean, you can't run a country on printing presses. That's going to devalue the currency. It's going to make it extraordinarily difficult to think about any kind of domestic agenda that will take us out of this collapsing economy. You cannot, I want to repeat, you cannot begin to tackle this severe recession heading to depression in the United States with this tremendous military commitment of 700 military bases abroad, $1 billion a day war spending in Iraq, losing war in Afghanistan, which every general except the General Petraeus admits that the war is being lost in Afghanistan and can't be won. So we got losing wars and the political leadership. I'm talking about Obama, who's even talking about increasing the American military commitment in Afghanistan. We have agreements by the Bush administration to continue American troops in Iraq for the next year. We have the pro-Israel lobby extracting its pound of flesh of $3 billion a year to fund Israeli settlements that are burning down olive fields instead of allowing us to engage in a as a honest broker in the Middle East. So we have domestic policies, domestic circumstances exacerbated by imperial wars, and I think that's the double whammy that we're facing today. How do you deal with a corrupt and bankrupt Wall Street and aggressive Zionism acting on behalf of Israeli expansionism and military civilian militarists who are blind to the disastrous effects of their wars on the American people?
And it strikes me, Jim, that everything you say I agree with right down the line, and it's never been more extreme in our history than now. You could go back to the problems that the guns and butter 1960s program caused, the inflation that followed. Right now we're in a deflationary environment, because asset prices across the board are pretty much in a downward trend, even though the last few days, I guess, the stock market has gone up, and there are always counter-rallies offsetting a trend, but the trend absolutely seems to be on the downside. I don't know how something can go up when you've got problems this immense to deal with. I mean, it just has to take a toll. So it will reverse. You've got all kinds of asset prices are deflating. So first, apparently, we're going to get some severe deflation, and then the way we're printing money, there's only one outcome to a printing press gone mad, and that is inflation and the potential for hyperinflation. And you know about the hyperinflation that hit Germany in the 1920s.
Yes, I've lived through hyperinflation in Latin America, and it's very frightening because people put on roller skates as soon as they get paid to buy food, and what I saw in Argentina in hyperinflation was every hour they'd go around and change the prices on goods to such a point that they stopped ringing up the price that was on the food labels. They would ring up a sheet that was in front of them about the raging price increases day to day. In fact, when I was there, some of my friends actually put their money in 30-day accounts at 10% per month interest rates in dollars. So they were paying their hotel bills on the interest payments they were getting on 30-day notes.
That is really incredible. That is absolutely incredible.
Well, I think the crisis internally in the United States with regard to the Middle East is going to have a real challenge in the next few months, because the Israeli government is still intent on confrontation with Iran. They're still convinced that the U.S. should go to war with Iran, despite everything that we're talking about, despite the debacle in the U.S. economy. And the question is whether there is sufficient concern in the United States with the economy to...
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindeman. I'm on with Jim Petras. Jim, I think the final coup de grace would be if we went to war with Iraq, even, I'm not, heaven forbid, invading.
Iran.
If they just unleashed a shock and awe attack, I think that would be the final coup de grace. It's hard to know what these people will do. They've spent almost 8 years making one mistake after another. It's a colossal, it's an unbelievable eight-year period in my mind.
Well, what is striking is that most Jews in Israel are secular, and yet the religious parties and groups, particularly the Judeo-fascists that are involved in the settlements in the West Bank, seem to be the driving force in Israel, and that the secular parties, including the Labor Party, are led by the nose. When you get these Jewish settlers burning down olive trees and assaulting their neighbors in Acre because they drive a car on a Jewish holiday, and the government stands by and lets this go on, one has to take a position that whatever the secularist and the Labor Party and the others say privately or in their rhetorical outpourings, the fact of the matter is the extreme right in Israel ultimately determines their relations with the Palestinians. Just one observation. Last night, Barak, the leader of the Labor Party, said that Israel should reconsider the Saudi Arabian plan, which involves Israel withdrawing from occupied territories in exchange for integration into the Middle East economies, that is, trade, investment, and recognition from all the Arab countries. So he says, well, we should think about the Saudi proposal for a comprehensive settlement involving peace, recognition, economic integration, exchange for giving up the occupied lands. And that proposal, that idea, which in my view would be the end of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, will go nowhere because the Labor Party and their partners, Kadima, are looking toward precisely the religious party to supplement their votes in parliament. So what is striking then further is that the great majority of American Jews that support Israel are allowing this religious fanatic settlers to define their position. So you have doctors, dentists, professors, investment brokers, all the prestigious intellectuals that support Israel, led by the nose, by these fanatical settlers, fundamentalists in Israel.
It's a terrible situation, Jim. I think people, especially Jews in this country who support Israel, I don't think they understand this. I don't think they realize what's going on, and that a small extremist minority can have such a powerful influence over the affairs of state, and the terrible, let alone the terrible things that are going on there. In my own family, the little I hear from them about it, I think my position, the ones who follow what I do, this is a core topic for me, the Palestinian conflict. Some of them look at me as a pariah because of what I'm doing, but they simply don't know what's going on. And it's a very, very self-destructive policy. The things that we're doing worldwide and what Israel is doing for each country is very, very self-destructive. This cannot go on forever. The line I like to quote is that policies that can't go on forever won't. They simply won't. And these will end, and they will end badly, if someone doesn't finally decide we're really going in the wrong direction and we have to change it. I swear, Jim, when people like Barack or Olmert come out and say that, we really have to withdraw from the territories, I honestly take it with a grain of salt. They don't mean dismantling settlements. And if they talk about a Palestinian state, they mean the Bantustan-type state, a completely untenable proposition. And I hear this stuff, and I say, well, we've heard this song before. It's not going to happen. And then, as you say, you've got the extremist elements that absolutely won't let it happen.
Yes. And I think what's even more revolting is that it's not just the Jewish Zionists, but you have the Christian Zionists, the fundamentalists, who are more Jewish than the Jews on this, or more Zionist than the Zionists. And then you have the Obamas and the Hillary Clintons and the the Republicans who add to the chorus. And I think that this, to me, is even more disgusting. I mean, there is this tenuous claim of Jews in the United States with their ties to Israel, and then you have the Gentiles, the non-Jews in the United States, who say that they pledge allegiance to Israel on whatever they do, whenever they'll do it. And that, to me, is revolting, because it tells you that American politicians are willing to sacrifice U.S. interests for the greater good of Israel.
Oh, indeed. Jim, we have to take another break. We'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lendman. I'm on with James Petras. We're talking about the Middle East. We talked about the financial crisis. Jim, your other book that I thought was a blockbuster when I read it on the Middle East, The Power of Israel in the United States. In that book and in your newest, I'll give the title again so people know it. These books really are blockbusters. There's so much in it of importance, and it just gets into the problems, the key problems that we're dealing with today, and they're all tied together. I mean, militarism and the things that are going on at home, they're all interconnected. And your new book, Jim, Zionism, Militarism, and the Decline of U.S. Power, to the uninitiated, it's quite amazing how powerful the Israeli lobby is and how deep-seated it is in the country and how they intimidate our elected officials, our federal elected officials.
Well, they intimidate them and they buy them.
Well, they buy them as well. There's no question.
I don't think they simply threaten to support opponents or finance alternative campaigns. But they provide them with a lot of money through political action committees, which have no identification formally with Israel, but are front groups for the pro-Israel lobby. So it's hard to detect them as channels for the pro-Israel lobby. But I think one of the things that got me into this, for years I was critical of Israeli policy, the Palestinians, but never wrote about it, never got myself really interested until the powerful thrust in the Bush administration and the Clinton administration of pro-Zionists in high office, and their policies of putting us in military confrontation with Middle East countries, and that's when I saw the danger of Zionism in the United States and of Zionists in high office, that they weren't outside the government petitioning to get more foreign aid for Israel, which you know, it could be you could criticize that, but they're actually in the government and making decisions for war and peace, which would affect millions of Americans, would affect our budget, etc. So that's really the turning point for me around the year 2001, where I began to seriously research this problem for two reasons. One, that Zionism meant large-scale, long-term, costly wars, destructive wars, reinforcing the militarists in the United States government. And secondly, what I found really appalling and provoked great indignation was that this was being done for a foreign power. It wasn't only the substance of the policies, but the whole undermining of our own sovereignty. Here we have formally a democracy where we vote for our representatives to pursue our interests, and we're seeing this perverted. I felt like I was back in Latin America or in Central America, and the U.S. ambassador was dictating policies to Honduras. I felt here we have the Israeli lobby or the Zionist power configuration dictating our Middle East policy and beyond. And I felt a great deal of anger that we were, in effect, being colonized and dictated to by a foreign power and its representatives in the United States. And they had the chutzpah to say that the interests of Israel are really the interests of the United States.
And, of course, they're not. When it comes down to it, we really have much, much different interests. I think a key point that you've pointed out a number of times, and in your new book, and there's no question about it. On the one hand, it's pretty clear how powerful corporate interests are in this country, but as powerful as the big oil interest is in the U.S., especially with the Bush administration, they are so closely tied to the oil industry. Big oil did not want a war with Iraq. Big oil does not want a war with Iran. Big oil thrives under conditions of stability. It sees only trouble when there are wars going on. And big oil,
losing,
I don't think it's made a dime
wars. They don't mind a coup, which a smooth coup in which
an
incumbent nationalist is replaced by a supporter of big oil. But they don't like mass wars, prolonged wars, wars that put in danger their fundamental interests. And that's exactly what's going on now. And what's appalling is the peace movement, so-called peace movement, and leftists and others that kept raising the issue of big oil because they were cowards, not willing to face up to the Zionists in the government and out of the government, in the Congress and in the Treasury, that were the engineers of our confrontational politics. They kept hiding behind big oil, providing us absolutely no evidence that any major oil company was pushing a war agenda. And I talk about socialists, leftists, progressives that were howling anti-Semites to anyone that pointed out the facts of life, that the pro-Israel lobby was writing up the legislation on sanctions and confrontation. They just absolutely refused to deal with any kind of factual accounts of the mechanics of politics of war.
And, Jim, on top of everything with the financial crisis and the election getting all the headlines now, it's almost as though the Iraq and the Afghan wars don't exist. You get thousands of people being killed in both countries every month.
And the other side of that, Steve, is if you look at the financial backers and key advisors to McCain and especially Obama, you find a very high percentage of pro-Israel supporters. And I'm talking about the principal advisors coming out of Chicago of Obama, who have a long history of being unconditional supporters of Israel and help fashion his Middle East perspective and his speeches. And I think that doesn't, those are very sinister omens for what we can expect in 2009 after Obama takes over as president.
Do you think we can reach a point? I agree, again, I agree with everything you have said on this program right down the line. How can I not? I mean, it makes so much sense. And yet at the same time, what we're going through now, I guess we don't have a bottomless pit. There may be a long way to go before we reach it. I really have no idea. But can you imagine a time coming, possibly in the not-so-distant future, where somebody is going to have to say, my God, we simply cannot go on spending like this. We have run up figures that are just unimaginable. We simply can't do this. Maybe the awakening, Jim, would be when the financial markets finally punish these policies. Maybe that's the awakening we need to have. And the only problem with that is when that happens even more than already, ordinary people will suffer the most. The big Wall Street types will walk away with their billions. Ordinary people will suffer the most. But at some point, I guess the power of money will make the decision for these people that they simply have to choose a new course or we're heading for financial ruin.
Well, I think there's a good argument for that. I remember in the 30s when Roosevelt came in, the American interventionism of the from the turn of the century to 1932, the U.S. actually sent warships off to Cuba in 1933. But from there on, the so-called good neighbor policy wasn't simply the goodwill of Roosevelt, but the depression and the tremendous decapitalization of the U.S. and Latin America. Many multinationals withdrew their capital back to their home base. There was a sharp decline in U.S. investment. There was a sharp decline in U.S. military interventions, even in the Caribbean and Central America, where it was standard operating procedure. There is also the example of the Depression and the buildup of arms at the end of the 30s, both Hitler's military buildup to put people back to work. But the problem is here, and I think this is what gives me some hope, is we're starting out with massive military bases overseas. When the economic crisis hits, and it's, in other words, military Keynesianism will not work when you have a huge debt to begin with, when you have a huge military unproductive machine already in place. It seems to me the only way toward an alternative of getting out of the crisis is demilitarizing rather than remilitarizing. The Hitler route out of the economic crisis can't be played out in a country which is already overloaded with military spending, and the road out is to convert military budgets and military expenditures into civilian expenditures.
Oh, exactly.
I don't think the Hitler route, the turn to fascism, and I think what we might get is a kind of protectionist nationalism, which could breed a kind of ultra-nationalism. But I can't see, after 7 years of warfare and losing war now in Afghanistan, a revitalization of militarism. I think the country, the economy can't support it. The public is totally focused on domestic issues. So in a way, the other factor is with the demise of Wall Street, some of the Israeli lobby's top donors are going to be unable to sustain that multi-million donations to AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, financing the United Jewish Appeal for Israel, etc. So the economic crisis, both in Israel and the United States, may force a kind of cutback on supporting expansionism. I don't know what you think of that.
Oh, one thought pops into my mind, Jim, and I use the quote in one of my recent articles, a quote from Winston Churchill, that the exact words I don't recall, but the quote the U.S. eventually comes around to making the right decision after first exhausting all other alternatives. So if he's right, if that's what happens this time, we'll first exhaust all other alternatives and maybe literally maybe even step over the abyss.
Well,
before...
there's some hopeful signs. I've been getting emails and other information from dissident Jewish voices both in the United States and Canada and in England that are really stepping up and pointing to an alternative policy toward Palestine. They're challenging the AIPAC. They don't have the money. They don't have the access to the media. They don't have the Harvard professors, et cetera, that the conventional pro-Israel lobby. But I'm heartened by the number of messages and speakers that I'm seeing step up and take on the powerful Jewish lobbies from within the Jewish communities. I think it's a good start. Whether it'll go very far, whether it'll resonate in the larger Jewish community, it's hard to say. But I must confess, if I compare today to when I started writing against the Zionist lobby, it's not a major breakthrough, but there is some reasonable basis for hope that a divided Jewish community provides us with some basis for putting some backbone in the Gentiles who claim they don't want to alienate the Jewish community. If you have a divided Jewish community, it might give some courage to some of these cowardly Gentiles who command and salute the Israeli flag.
Jim, some months back, I quoted John Pilger saying much what you're saying now, and it could very well be a hopeful sign. I guess these things emerge slowly. I think sooner or later it really will happen again. These terrible policies, these terrible directions simply can't continue forever, and we just compound one mistake with continuing greater mistakes, and the Bush administration will end there's no question that this is by far the worst administration in our history. And I can't imagine that even historians who would like to support the conservative cause, in the end, I just can't imagine that they won't be awfully critical of 8 years that has just been an unmitigated disaster, whether we're talking about the Middle East, the Palestinian conflict.
What bothers me in that, Steve, is the fact that many progressives are not raising the issues that should be raised in their support for Obama. That, to me, is the most disastrous course.
Oh, I agree with you.
People that I'm not supporting Obama. I'm supporting Nader because I don't trust Obama to be any more progressive than Bush on the Middle East. But what bothers me is that all these liberals and leftists that are backing Obama are not raising the issue of Israeli militarism. They're not raising the issue of Zionist unconditional support for Israel. They're keeping their mouth shut and going along with all the dreck that Obama is peddling on Israel and his unconditional support. And that's not going to help the cause once he gets elected, because they've already given up the fight before he's elected.
And he'll get a pass at the outset, Jim. Let's take a break and we'll come back and finish up the hour.
It's a fact. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, all banks in these United States create money out of thin air for every single loan they issue. With never-ending late fees, over-the-limit fees, and higher interest rates, it has become mathematically impossible to repay all debt, making all of us slaves to our creditors. The Federal Debt Relief System has created a successful attorney-backed program to legally eliminate credit card debt, personal loans, lines of credit, and other unsecured debts which have been fraudulently created by the banks. We can terminate your unsecured debt within 18 months with a much lower monthly payment, ending with nothing on your credit report. Join the thousands of Americans who now breathe with a sigh of relief because they have legally eliminated their debt. Instead of living each day in fear and frustration, it's time to take action and turn your life around. Call the Federal Debt Relief System at 877-943-8600. That's 877-943-8600. Or visit FDRS.org. Find out how you can break the cycle of debt slavery. Visit FDRS.org today.
Let me tell you why I take Beta Prostate. As a man, I know my chances of having an enlarged prostate is pretty good. As a matter of fact, by the age of 40, our prostate can swell to the size of an apricot. And by age 60, our prostate can enlarge to the size of a lemon. Now, your prostate is right next to your bladder, so this is the main reason why men are up all night going to the bathroom. A good night's sleep is important for every man and their wives, since every time you wake up, she wakes up. So what do? You see your doctor for checkups, eat a healthy diet, and take what I take. It's called Beta Prostate, and it's a natural supplement that helps maintain prostate health. Over 2 million bottles of Beta Prostate have been sold. Why? Because it works. Try it free today by calling 1-800-362-5848. That's 1-800-362-5848. Don't put this call off until tomorrow. Try it free today. Dial 1-800-362-5848.
All right, I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Jim Petras. Jim, I want to emphasize to listeners the importance of your new book. You really get into Zionism, militarism, and the decline of U.S. power, brand new, just out. You really get into in great depth the corrosiveness of militarism and how it's simply destroying us. If we can't veer away from this, this is destroying us more than ever now with the terrible financial pressures going on in the country now, which was not part of your book. But I mean, you could add, if you come up with a new edition, you could add another chapter that everything you said you'd say in spades, because we don't have the funds to be pouring into these programs that we're doing now, and you go into it in such a brilliant way that this book is important reading, and I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to talk about it with you on the air. Oh, some final comments, Jim, that you can add.
Well, I think we have to get America back to work. I think this whole business of a service economy, of a paper economy, of putting everything into Wall Street, finance, bonds, flipping housing, borrowing money for consumption, I think we have to get back to a productive economy. I have to say we have to get back to a manufacturing economy. And I don't mean making cheap textiles. I mean we have to invest in the higher quality items that we can make here based on our technological know-how. And if the private sector can't do it, I think we have to look to new forms of public ownership, public investment, cooperatives, collectives, different forms in which partnership, extended partnership of engineers and workers can remake America from a paper economy to a real economy. And I think that's the direction we have to go. We have to get away from the FIRE economy, finance, insurance, real estate, speculation, all of these fake paper structures, and get back to what made this country great, which is essentially manufacturing, social services, extending the social web to sustain a public health system so that our producing classes don't have all the overhead of booming private education cost, private health system. That's totally unsustainable. We need an efficient public sector, public education to educate and have healthy workers in a productive economy, and we can do it.
Instead of the casino capitalism we have now.
Casino militarism, casino Zionism, casino non-productive and speculative and useless millionaires who don't provide jobs, don't deliver services. That's got to end, and I think we're going to head in that direction.
We done well better. We've got 1% of the population that owns over half of the national wealth.
And they don't produce anything useful.
They do absolutely nothing. Everything they do is counterproductive.
That's true, Steve. I think everything is on our side because they are ringing up zeros. Zeros in new goods, zeros in health care, zeros in financing a quality education. They are a zero category that promises nothing for the future and only saddles us with problems today.
Jim, there's no question about that. I'm afraid we're out of time. The Don Hour always goes by too fast, especially with somebody like you on. Again,
keep up the excellent work, Steve. I've downloaded your current article, and I'm looking forward to reading it with my lunch this afternoon.
Oh, well, I hope I don't give you indigestion.
No, the contrary.
I've got another one coming right behind it in a couple of days.
You are the most productive person on my web. By far.
It's become an obsession.
It's a healthy one.
Indeed. Jim, thank you so much. It was a
okay.
Glorious joy.